Hey guys. How's it going? I'm Scott Horton and I'm here and this is my show. Remarkable, right? I tend to show up every day. Unless I can't. Today on the show, bad news. Bad news and interviews. Bad news and good interviews. About bad news. Yeah, there's silver linings in some of it, I guess. I don't know. Mitchell Prothero is going to be back on the show live from Kurdistan. He's been reporting out of Erbil. And been doing, I don't know. I think the best work, the best written journalism out of Iraq at the dawn of Iraq War III here. Patrick was doing a lot of really great stuff, but he left Baghdad a few weeks back. He was there for, I guess, the first 3 or 4 weeks of this. Prothero's still in Erbil. He's staying, I think, till September, at least. And then I think I read on Twitter that he's being switched out for... Oh, my mic's a little low there. He's being switched out for Jonathan Landay in another month. Anyway, point being, Prothero, man, he's written some really great stuff and everything. I've been interviewing him pretty much once a week for the last, say, 5-6 weeks, maybe more than that, on the Iraq issue here. And all of his, writing and statements have held up. And, well, anyway, I've been getting, as much... response for my Mitchell Prothero interviews as anything, as any interviews I've ever done, really, including Ron Paul interviews and Daniel Ellsberg interviews and other things. People are really reacting to what they're hearing from Prothero because they can tell that, it's quality stuff. And also, it's scary as hell. There's only one answer. And the answer is America's going to war. I'm watching on TV now CNN footage, probably not faked, of they're going to deliver some food aid in northern Iraq, and people scramble to jump aboard the helicopter and throw their kids aboard the helicopter and try to get out of there. These Yazidis fleeing the ISIS school shooters, as Prothero calls them. Khmer Rouge, as Coburn calls them. And that's the thing of it, man. And the truth is, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is what this is. It's Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's group. They are brutal, murderous women and children killing sons of bitches, man. They are absolutely horrible. And so, as long as them being horrible is a good enough excuse for America to go back to war, then that's it. There's just no arguing with how horrible these guys are. And it's already on. And the worst part of it is that, like Peter Van Buren said on the show last week, tell me how this ends. This doesn't end. We're sworn to protect Shiistan. We're sworn to protect Kurdistan. We're sworn that there can't be a safe haven for jihadists anywhere in the Sunni triangle of Iraq. I think it's still questionable whether they're good guys or bad guys over there in eastern Syria. But in western Iraq, they must not have a safe haven at all forever, huh? That means occupy the place forever. That means Obama admits to the war, concedes to the war parties, facts, quote unquote, and their point of view. As long as there are angry Sunni Arabs with rifles who are willing to insurge against their government, we got to fight them. And never mind the fact that anybody can just ask their own brain. Hey, brain, you think maybe invading would make it worse? You think maybe killing as many of these guys as we can might make even more of them? and you'll have a pretty good, you know, idea. You'll have to admit that it's a very real possibility. The entire American Army and Marine Corps weren't able to get rid of these guys, only made them. For years. Now, the local Sunni tribes did turn on them and marginalize them, but that was back in 07. I think those lessons have been learned. And then again, you know, these ISIS guys, they really are such really bad guys that they will eventually turn the local population against them. Hey! Where's that? Ian, I heard you. In case you didn't know. Check 1, 2. Yeah, loud and clear. Yeah, anyway, I forgot what I was going to say. A bunch of killing people. U.S. government killing people from now on. And there's a coup going on. We're going to talk about that on the show today, too. I don't know if it's really a coup or not. It's kind of a coup, but they're getting rid of Maliki. They're doing everything they can to give him the DM treatment. And he seems to be doing everything he can to hang on to power. It started out that it was really just the United Iraqi Alliance had this vote and picked the new guy. But then it turned out that, they actually did call together some kind of quorum in the parliament and have some kind of vote for the, what's his name? I think I'm missing some tabs here on my reboot, guys. Oh, here we go. Washington Post. Meet Haider al-Abadi. The man named Iraq's new prime minister. And who is he? He's from the Dawa party, just like Maliki. Now, they say in here that he spent his years in exile in London instead of Tehran. So, okay. That may or may not mean that he's more loyal to America and Britain than the Iranian government, but I don't know necessarily why to believe that. And then, so, yeah, I mean, what's the plan of the Dawa Party? The plan of the Dawa Party all along has been to let Sunni Stan go. They never really wanted to rule it anyway. That's why the army retreated in the face of ISIS's assault, is because it wasn't their territory at all. And obviously the government didn't have their back at trying to hold it, so the call was to retreat. Because what's the Shiite army really going to do? Conquer the Anbar province? The one that the American Army and Marine Corps couldn't conquer? No. But that's what they meant by strong federalism all the time anyway. And as I forgot who it was pointed out last night, this has been Biden's plan all along, is to split the country into three. And it's probably the inevitable result, really, of overthrowing Saddam Hussein. Even if they hadn't de-Ba'athified the government, and even if they hadn't fired the entire Iraqi army, the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, whoever is making a phone call on the line, I can hear you on my show now. Good morning, you're all over my radio show right now. All right, cool. Holy shit. All right, well, let me see. Your call is going out on my show right now. Very loudly. Yeah, well, there you go. I guess I could turn that down for a minute. All right. Well, anyway, coming up on the show, interviews, technical difficulties. It's going to be great.
How can you shoot women, children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
All right, well, cool. And isn't it supposed to be commercials right now? Check, check, check. Hey, LRN, I can't hear my commercials either. I should be in break right now. Can you guys hear me? Jeez, I ought to turn on the Beasties in the background or something.
I'm interested in the question of motivation of these hijackers. My question is really directed to the agents. But what have you found out about why these men did what?
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. I had a little bit of technical difficulties, but I think we got it worked out now. Seems like it. Like I said, Mitchell Prothero is going to be on the show to talk about what the hell is going on in Iraq. And I admit, he's not a libertarian, and he may not say 100% libertarian things when it comes to his analysis of the situation, but I don't care about that, because that's not his job. He's a reporter. He's here to tell us what the hell. We can decide what to do about it. Well, not that we get to decide, but we can decide what we would like to see done or not done about it. But he is pretty reasonable anyway, and he sure as hell knows what he's talking about. That's coming up here in just a few minutes. And then Dan McAdams is going to be on the show from the Ron Paul Institute. He's going to have some opinions about what's going on in Iraq, and also we're going to talk about Ukraine as well with Dan McAdams. He used to be Ron Paul's foreign policy advisor in his congressional office and is good on pretty much everything, as far as I can tell. And then the great Will Grigg. Will Grigg is the best libertarian when it comes to writing about local police abuse of American citizens. Well, he's my favorite anyway. I got to give credit to Radley Balco. That guy really is changing the world on this topic. He's done such great journalism so consistently for so long. He even won himself a place at the Washington Post, where he has a great blog, but also does long-form journalism there. And to have someone with correct libertarian precepts like Balco writing at a place like the Washington Post on an issue like the militarization of the police and the unaccountability and immunity and impunity with which they operate, treating American citizens as their enemies, etc., is huge. And I don't mean to sell him short. But Will's my favorite because when it comes to the prose, man, he's just great to read. He's just great to read. And when it comes to his precepts, he's more libertarian than Balco. He's hardcore, man. He's an anarcho-individualist like you and me. I'm very tolerant of Balco's shtick, which is, hey, no, we need cops. We just don't need SWAT teams. Not like this. Not this many, and not with this many jobs to do. We sure don't need them. That's important, too. Anyway, it shouldn't have to be a contest, but if it is, and these guys are in competition, friendly competition with each other, for who can do the most to make America less of a police state, well then, good. That's what the free market's all about. And if you think that you could write better about local police abuse than Radley Balco or Will Grigg, well then, to paraphrase George W. Bush, bring them on! Come on! I should have said it, and then that would have been better. Go ahead and try it! And let's see how many insanely awesome essays that you can write and distribute to people. Anyway, the great Will Grigg, he's going to be on the show. And now, it's been kind of a train wreck so far, the show, but it's about to kick in and get good. Let me just say a couple of things here, man. I don't know if you guys saw this. Maybe if you're lurking around my Twitter feed, you might have or something. But Reason Magazine has published, I believe, two different essays on intervention in Iraq being all right. Yeah, let's go save the Yazidis. Are you kidding me? I mean, I don't even want to give it attention because it's so lame. Save the Yazidis? In other words, here's another blank check to go back to Iraq and do whatever you want. You know? It's like go get Saddam meant stay for 10 years and kill a million people and fight a civil war for the Iranian sock puppets and blah, 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 create a giant bin Laden stan in the West and a Ayatollah stan in the East and destroy every other ethnic and religious minority group. And same thing here. Oh, go save the Yazidis on the mountain means, yeah, go ahead and go back to war. Thanks a lot for falling for it, you idiots. And then, they published a thing about Moshe Feiglin, the guy that we talked about on the show repeatedly over the past few weeks here, who's been writing open letters to Netanyahu and articles in the newspaper saying it's time to just kick and or kill all the Palestinians out of the Gaza Strip and take it. And Reason Magazine ran a thing about, yeah, this guy's a libertarian, you know, except for that part. But other than that, yeah, he's really good on drugs and gay marriage and, oh my God, Reason Magazine, seriously? The guy is for the complete and total denial of individual human property rights. I was going to say and property rights, but no, it's the same damn thing. If you own yourself, then you own that which you just acquire, and it's a simple matter of kind of a logical sort of thing there. And so, in other words, this guy is an outright fascist. This guy's, the Kahane, get rid of them all movement in Israel was banned from politics. That, you know, back when. But Reason Magazine, instead of running an article saying, look at how Israel is becoming a right-wing fascist dictatorship. Look at how they are warring against the very idea that human beings own property. Like they're some kind of Stalinists. And instead, and it could have been all about centered on the same guy. Instead, the article is all about what a great guy he is, what a great libertarian he is, other than, you know, that one little deviation, which they don't even really complain about. They just go, well, you know, that's another topic. What? And then there's Rand Paul. And Rand Paul has finally come out and broken his silence on intervention in Iraq and has said he's not so much opposed to bombing, but he would like to point out that America has more or less been on the side of ISIS in Syria this whole time. Well, thank you, Senator Paul. First of all, please go and study so that when they ask you about that, you can actually answer like you know what you're talking about, because you're pretty much right, although not exactly. So get it right so that you can defend your position on what's been going on in Syria. It's important. He blew it. Actually, in the quote, he says for the last year. When, no, it's been for the last 3 years, 2.5 at least. You see right there, the laziness there. But anyway, and then, maybe bombing Iraq is okay. I wouldn't necessarily disagree. What? Because taking a principal position that America made it this way, and this can only make it worse, is just too difficult? Getting in a fight with Hillary Clinton in the media and whooping her ass when the American people are already more peaceful than you on the issue is too difficult? It's so sad. And you know, that's the other thing about Rand Paul that's really got me right now is all the headlines are about him lying. I don't know what else to call it. Him lying and saying, I never said that I thought the Civil Rights Act or any part of it was a bad idea. I never said aid to Israel was a bad idea. I never said all these things that you can quote it. Wolf Blitzer played the clip of him back where it was Wolf Blitzer saying, now, wait a minute, let me make sure I got you right. You're saying end aid to Israel. Yeah. And what do you have to say about that? Your video of me talking is forged, Wolf. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. It's Fun Drive Week here on the Scott Horton Show. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate if you like things like this. Mitchell Prothero is next on the show, reporting for McClatchy Newspapers out of Kurdistan, and has a brand new piece, just hit the wire 3 minutes ago, according to Google News. Maliki signals he will step aside peacefully, easing tensions in Baghdad. You don't say. Welcome back to the show, Mitchell.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you here. Do tell about Maliki, please.
Well, I got to credit my colleague. We run a bureau here, and Adam Ashton is a reporter from McClatchy as well. He's based down in Baghdad. We worked on this together today, and he gets the credit because Baghdad's hotter than Erbil, which I didn't think would be possible. But what we actually found is that basically Maliki was forced out. He was going to stay in. He was probably willing to resort to violence to do so. But unlike a lot of these Middle Eastern dictators, and unlike, let's say Saddam Hussein, he had what we'd call a political tribe behind him. He had the Dawa Party, and he had control over the armed forces. But a lot of the armed forces also were beholden to Iran because of training and weaponry and basically just concerns over the situation with ISIS. So as he kind of tried to gather steam to maybe do a self-coup, I don't know what it is when the president decides not to leave The prime minister decides not to leave, his support just quickly evaporated. I wouldn't exactly call it a rule of law situation. It was just that essentially the people that would have had to go with him had decided that he was no longer competent and decided to play by the rules of the game as set by the Iraqi constitution, which, for a couple of days there was pretty tense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really something. And so now the guy that's up to replace him, is it already settled? They haven't had the vote yet on the next guy, have they?
Well, no, what they do is this is a parliamentarian system. And so what you end up doing is you get tasked to form a government is basically what we're looking at right here. And so Al-Abidi, his name's Haider Jawad Al-Abidi, is been asked by the president of Iraq, which is a fairly ceremonial position in these cases. But one of the things the president does do is once there's been an election and the, you know, party that has the most votes, he, you know, basically takes their representative and says, okay, you're going to be the prime minister. Now form a government, build a coalition, name people to a cabinet. You've got 1 month to do that. Maliki had tried to claim that because they hadn't already done that in the month since the election, all of it was invalid, and because of national security interests, he should remain. But basically, it's been overruled, although there is some sense that Maliki might try to go to the courts. At this point, people are pretty much dismissing him. Mm-hmm. So we've got a new guy. Haider Abadi is tasked with seeing if he can bring this incredibly fractious, you know, Iraqi parliament together around the idea of, hey, let's not all die at the hands of the Islamic State, and, put together a functioning government to try to get this thing back on track.
Mm-hmm. And now this new guy, he's Dawa Party too, right?
Of course, Dawa did win the election. Again, this is how, you know, for listeners in the United States, they'll be less familiar with how this goes. But in a parliamentary system like this, usually the head of the party becomes prime minister, the party that won the most seats in parliament. And so Dawa did win the most seats. It's just that they basically had lost confidence in their prime minister, you know, the guy, and decided to put up a different person, which was well within their rights, despite the protests by, you know, Prime Minister Maliki, who does remain in office as what they call a caretaker prime minister until the government is able to be formed, if one is able to be formed. That will be no easy task. Abadi and, the president and a bunch of these guys, they've got a lot of hard choices to make. They're going to have to come up with a coalition that's bigger than just the Dawa party and, assign cabinet posts and sort of divvy up that big pile of oil money among different groups of people. Mm.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess it's a fair bet, though, that America is putting pressure on the Kurds to go ahead and go along with this new guy for now, at least, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, look.
And the Sunnis boycotted the election this year, unlike 2010 when they did pretty good but lost anyway, right?
Right. Well, the Sunnis are always going to lose. They're 20%. You know, they keep saying they're 60, but I mean, geez. Yeah. They're delusional on this front. I guess they just ran Iraq for so long they thought they could change math. But yeah, the Kurds, look, at this stage, I don't even know that necessarily. I know that there's a strong sense that Kurdistan would like to be as independent as possible. The president of Kurdistan, Masoud Barzani, is an extremely shrewd operator. And I'm not positive that he wants total independence for Kurdistan at this point. What he wants is to be able to run his own shop how he sees fit. He's got about 90% of that. And the Americans have pressured him somewhat to not go completely off the rails. But, you know, and the way that they can do that is by not supporting him buying weapons, essentially on the black market, which is what he would have to legally do according to international law, instead of buying them through Baghdad, and by selling oil on his own. What everybody, and I'm pretty sure even President Barzani, at least at this stage, would like to see is a competent government come together in Baghdad, start paying the Kurds the money that they're supposed to be getting each month, which is about 17% of the Iraqi revenue. Maliki's been withholding that from them for the entire year, which is one of the reasons why they've been trying to sell oil on the black market. I think it's up to $6 or $7 billion right now that they're owed. And somebody who could come up with that money for them, that they've been, you know, operating under good faith, allow them to continue to keep their autonomy, and maybe kick the can that's known as the oil-rich city of Kirkuk down the road a little bit for a final status agreement while accepting that, you know, the Iraqi government is not in any position right now to secure it. Mm-hmm. The Kurds control Kirkuk. There are no Iraqi units to push up to connect to it. There's only the Islamic State between the two. So for all practical purposes, Kirkuk will be in the hands of the Kurds for now. But they can worry about that legal status designation, you know, after they've solved the part where a third of the country's in the hands of the Islamic Caliphate.
Yeah. Well, and I guess I need to pull up a map. I don't have one right in front of me here. But isn't Kirkuk right on the border of the frontier with the Islamic State at this point?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, no, it's absolutely. It's basically the last thing controlled by the government, in sense, if you consider the Kurds part of Iraq still, which they are on paper, It's pretty much the last thing in government hands before you get down to Diyala province on the outskirts of Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that is one of the Kurdish front lines. The northern lines have been what's been in the news for the last 10 days or so. It's been very hot up here.
I have a question about that, too. Sure. Just a point of confusion, you could help straighten me out. I looked at the map, and it seems like Mount Sinjar, where these Yazidis were holed up there, is on the far side of Mosul from Erbil.
We're having a little problem with Skype?
Oh, yeah. Well, it seems like it's gone away now.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I was hearing a little echo there, too. Sorry. It sounds okay now, Mitchell?
It seems like we're doing okay now. Okay. Just repeat the question.
Okay.
And we can get going.
Yeah, so the question was, it seems like Mount Sinjar is on the far side of Mosul from Erbil. And I was wondering how the hell the Kurds are supposed to be able to control that territory in order to allow.
You're really cutting.
Oh, I lose you.
Okay, yeah, I lost you again. I'm going to see if it's the headset or the connection. How are we doing?
You sound okay to me.
Okay, now I can hear you. All right.
Check one. All right. Well, we're on the phone with Mitchell Prothro, live from Erbil, Kurdistan right now, guys, so it's okay. You got to forgive technical difficulties here a little bit. The question was, Mount Sinjar, where the Yazidis were, it seems like on the map, it's on the far side of Mosul, controlled by ISIS, from Erbil, controlled by the Kurds, and I was just wondering how the hell the Kurds are able to secure any kind of transit zone for those Yazidis to get out of there.
Well, that's been a humanitarian disaster of possibly biblical proportions. What had happened was Kurds had held a border crossing and Sinjar when most of the western desert fell. You can think of it more as an arc going over the top of that mountain above Sinjar that everybody's been seeing the refugees coming out of. And that area is controlled by the Kurds. To the south of that mountain is now controlled by the Islamic State. But there's a lot of fighting coming from the Syrian side towards Sinjar to try to retake it. But you can't drive in a straight line between Sinjar and Erbil, or else you'll run into the Islamic State.
I got you. Yeah, wow, what a crisis. So can you give us an update then on especially the American part of the war there in Kurdistan or on its borders?
Sure. It's been very, very restrained. President Obama's made it clear to all parties that he is not going to be the Iraqi Air Force. And I think he's been pretty legit on that point. He also made it clear that he just, you know, and I wrote this last week, it was one part humane, one part realpolitik, and two parts logistics, that they simply couldn't allow Erbil to fall if it was going to the Islamic State for just a host of reasons. Economic interests, large expatriate community, evacuating an embassy, one guy told me, a landlocked embassy, like a consulate section and a pretty large military CIA installation would have to be evacuated. And, you know, you're so far from the coast, you basically have to truck everybody out through Turkey, which would be incredibly dangerous. And it just, you know, on five or six different levels, it just wasn't going to be acceptable for Erbil to get overrun. So they authorized airstrikes. There's been a handful a day. This is not an extensive bombing campaign. It's actually, you know, the term precision bombing gets tossed around a lot when people don't mean it. But from what we can tell, it's extremely precision. CENTCOM even tells us exactly what they hit. Like, they see three guys setting up a mortar that had previously been fired at Kurdish positions, and a drone zaps it, waits 15 minutes for the guys to come back to see the damage, and then zaps them again. That type of thing. They're being very specific about the targets they're hitting. One release yesterday explained that an armored personnel carrier was shooting at Yazidis as they were trying to flee the mountains, so an F-18 came by and blew it up. It's not like a shock and awe type situation. They're doing just enough to keep the Pesh in charge of the controls of the border of Kurdistan and waiting for the Iraqis to get their act together as a full government before they make any more decisions on further military support.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so what about if the Islamic State marches on Kirkuk? Is America going to protect Kirkuk?
I would expect that at this stage it's going to be very hard for the Islamic State to march on anybody in the north. And I think they're smart enough to know that they can't. It's kind of all the same battle zone when you're from an F-18. And there have been a couple of strikes down there, although not fully down in Kirkuk. There hasn't been much fighting. I do believe, and this is strictly my own opinion and intuition or gut or call it whatever, that the Islamic State would be much more interested in Kirkuk than they would be Erbil. From what we can tell so far, with the exception of a handful of Christian villages, they have no interest in trying to take over areas that they can't hold. meaning they want large, somewhat sympathetic or easily cowed Sunni populations. They don't want a hold of, you know, 1.5 million Kurds who will all literally run out into the street with AKs and butcher knives if that's what it takes to fight them off. I mean, it would be a massacre. I think on Thursday there was some danger of the Islamic State hitting the city, but trying to control 1.5 million Kurds who really don't want you there, it would have been incredibly difficult for the Islamic State. And if I figured that out, they probably know it as well.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, we've talked about for all these weeks that, well, they could, you know, go headlong into Baghdad and get themselves all killed trying, but they're not stupid. They haven't done that. It seems right to me that what they want to do is expand as far out as makes sense to and then consolidate that. That's what we've seen.
That's what they've more or less done. When they were pushing on Erbil, there was a couple of reasons why, and this is last week, and I'll tell you, it really came down to a 12-hour decision or less. They were 20, 30 minutes outside of the city, and on Thursday I went up and saw the front lines, and it was my professional and personal opinion that the Kurds could not hold without airstrikes. And at that stage, I had to start reviewing plans, figuring the airport was going to be down. Did I try for Turkey, try for maybe the city of Sulaymaniyah, which is further up in the mountains and easier to defend. And in this case, the Americans at that point did start airstrikes and the Islamic State decided not to come in. It would be very hard for them to mount an offensive because it's just a big, flat, open desert plain. And, you know, drones and F-18s wouldn't even have to work very hard to decimate an attack from them. Right. But what we've seen now is they're bunkering down along a front line. So I would expect that it will be very hard for even more than limited air power to dislodge them alone. Again, as everybody's always said, this is going to require a long, drawn-out, and patient political solution where over time the Sunni tribes of Iraq are going to be brought back into the fold by the government, convinced that it's okay and that they won't be mistreated like they were under Maliki, and then get them and equip them to turn on the Islamic State and drive out these guys that, you know, have basically tried to form their own caliphate. That's the only strategy that doesn't come off insane. Whether or not it's a practical one, I don't know, but I do know the other ones are not practical. So, you know, this right now what we're seeing is a lot of front lines developing where I think it's going to be pretty static unless the Islamic State does do something like try to take Kirkuk. I would not rule out a spectacular attack on Baghdad, if only just to show the Iraqi people that their government is finished and cannot protect them, but I don't think they would try to hold it. And, you know, we always forget, we've been obsessed with Iraq now for the last couple of weeks. The Syria is still going on, and the Islamic State considers that just as important and as much a part of their country that they've tried to form their caliphate as Iraq. So you could also see a broad offensive push into other areas of Syria. I think in the last month, Syrian army has lost more soldiers than they lost in any other previous month of the 3-year civil war.
Really?
People just have to pay. Yeah, I think it was this month. We have to be careful on that, but I do know there was about a 2-week period where they lost nearly 1,200 men in fighting against the Islamic State.
Including having their heads put up on pikes.
All kinds of stuff. Yeah, you really do not want to be a Syrian soldier and captured by the Islamic State.
All right, now let me get back to Syria, you know, or Western, you know, caliphate in a sec. But I wanted to ask you about what difference it makes. This political solution that you're talking about, to me, sounds just as crazy as anything that anybody else is saying about what to do here.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about, it's 7 years since the surge was supposed to accomplish what you just said, and it did accomplish the part about getting the Sunni tribes to turn on al-Qaeda, but it didn't accomplish the part about the political reconciliation necessary enough to put Humpty Dumpty back together again here. And now it's 7 years later, and as you've reported, al-Qaeda in Iraq, ISIS as it's now called, is however many times as powerful as it was back then. And so, you know, you might as well be saying, let the Belgians sort it out. This whole thing is just, I mean, who's going to do what here?
Well, that's the whole thing is, you know, first off, to be fair, you know, America didn't blow it with the Sunni reconciliation. They, you know, they left like President Obama basically got elected to do. He was elected to get America out of Iraq and Afghanistan. He got America out of Iraq. And, you know, as they were on their way out, they warned. I've had so many guys tell me this, even on the Kurdish side, they were screaming about it, too. you know, warning Maliki as the Americans left, do not blow this.
Yeah, but Mitch, what I'm saying is, I'm not talking about Obama. I'm talking about Petraeus and Bush in 2007. They never met the benchmarks in the first place. They never met the benchmark.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But meaning that the failure, you know, that was a failure of 2007, but it bought them enough breathing room for Obama to pull them out.
Right.
What I'm talking about is when you look at the strategy of co-opting the Sunni tribes, they were properly co-opted. They did go along with it. And then after we left, Maliki engaged on a, you know, 3-year campaign to infuriate them in every possible way he could,
right,
which has led to this.
Right. But and now, so how likely is it that they could, that the very best technocrat in charge of Baghdad could recreate that situation in a successful way, only do it better than Maliki did in 07 and really integrate the Sunnis back in and become friends again? I mean, come on.
It seems thin, man, I got to tell you, but the every other option I see looks even worse.
Well, what about doing nothing? What about just waiting until the Sunnis of the caliphate decide that they don't like these guys and don't want to live in their police state anymore? After all, there's not that much oil wealth and stuff. It's not like they're taking over Germany here. They're taking over the desert.
Well, yeah, no, I guess, you know, that's actually, this is the flip side of the same thing. And frankly, that's what I would describe the American strategy as right now, is at some point, everybody's going to have a turnaround on this. They're going to get sick of it, and then you support them. But, I mean, I don't think anybody's talking about suddenly dropping in 5,000 American advisors, although I could be wrong. I mean, wars do have a tendency to, you know, creep along and escalate.
Yeah.
So we've certainly seen that historically in the past. But the strategy and everything that I hear when I talk to U.S. officials, you know, for the first time in 12 years as a war correspondent covering America's wars, I have these realistic conversations with American diplomats and military officials where for the first time they actually seem to know the limits of their power and seem to have a realistic assessment of what's going on the ground. And what they say is, like, I mean, I've had guys tell me flat out, the reason why we're not helping the Iraqi army anymore is because it wouldn't matter. They would still lose. So why should we throw bad money after good?
Yeah.
Right now, when they want to get their act together, there are things that we can do to help them, but they are going to have to be the ones to solve this. You know, and, you know, simply put, we're not going to wantonly bomb all over Iraq trying to kill guys in pickup trucks because Maliki's, you know, an incompetent leader. And so, you know, but you're right. When you look at the choices again, I mean, I think I've said this on the show, you know, Obama's standing in front of a buffet of extremely unappetizing entrees. He's going to end up having to pick one of them and they all suck.
Yeah.
So, you know, what we've seen from them is a maximum amount of restraint in the sense that they're going to do the very narrowest thing they can. It's very realistic and very smart to not let Erbil fall. I mean, people talked about the oil, and yes, that's totally legitimate. America has an economic interest in the Kurdish region, but they also have an emotional interest. And these are the only guys who got their act together while America was spending $1 trillion and 4,000 lives. These are the only people who actually ran with that opportunity, and they deserve some support for that. Then you throw in the practical, which is if you're going to end up having to deal with, you know, these guys out here in the desert, this is a perfectly good strategic place with allies who like you. You don't just let allies fall like that because you don't feel like getting involved. So on multiple levels, and then you throw in the part where it would have been a complete nightmare to evacuate the embassy. You know, it turned into a no-brainer. But that's certainly different than B-52s doing like arc light giant strikes across central Iraq, trying to kill off all these guys and support a massive Iraqi, you know, offensive to retake Tikrit and Kirkuk, you know, these places, you know, or push up to Kirkuk. You know, we're just not seeing that. And I'm telling you, when I talk to U.S. officials, none of them see that on the table right now. They just say there's a few things we can do to help these guys, and we'll do it when they get their act together.
Yeah. Well, it seems like in some of Obama's statements, he is basically waiting for Maliki's replacement, at least, to see how much he'd do. But, they, you know, last week they said, well, we're going to protect the Yazidis on the mountain on Thursday. And then on Friday they said, yes, we're also drawing a red line around Baghdad. And then on Saturday they said, we will not let there be a safe haven for terrorists in Iraq. So you could drive the Vietnam War through a Gulf of Tonkin loophole like that, if that's what they want to call it.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, the precedent's there, but look, at this stage, you've got an Islamic caliphate that's openly hostile to the United States, whose predecessors have killed thousands of Americans and would love to kill thousands more. So in terms of an excuse to get militarily involved, you don't really need one at this stage. These people are America's enemies, and they do plan on killing Americans at some point. It's just realistically, how do you go about that without, well, doing it the most effectively And, you know, this is the question. And so I'm not defending anybody's policies, but I do not see airstrikes on the outskirts of Baghdad. I think when they say Baghdad's a red line, I think they mean the Baghdad airport's a red line so they can evacuate the embassy. You know, in terms of the Yazidis, yes, they've done a very small number of strikes to make it easier for the Yazidis to get out of there. And they've dropped some food and supplies to varying degrees of success.
Yeah.
One of the problems they've had is...
You know what, though, Mitchell? What about all of us in flyover country who don't want to be the target of more terrorist attacks by these guys? And we're looking at the Post, and it says in there that they, on one hand, the Islamic State is celebrating American intervention because it means that they're the ones opposing the Americans, which is the best PR that they could hope for their purposes, and at the same time vowing revenge upon American citizens for what our government is doing.
Well, I know these guys already. I mean, and the simple fact is they've been fighting you already. They just changed their name and expanded the franchise. So I don't think that you're going to find it any more antagonistic. It's not like suddenly Americans became fair game to the Islamic State.
Well, I mean, wasn't there a near enemy, far enemy debate here going on between those who are pro-caliphate and those who would rather fight Americans? And we're turning the pro-caliphate ones into internationalists, into Zawahiriites again.
I think they're going in the direction. I don't think they care much what we do, except I think they would like some American soldiers to shoot at. Look, these guys are really smart. They're on their own program, and you know, we're not going to get them to change up simply. They're not going to suddenly become more hostile to the United States. They're not going to decide that because now it's justified to plan a suicide bombing in New York because, you know, Obama saved Erbil. You know, it doesn't seem realistic. These guys are on their own agenda. They definitely believe that they need to clash with the West in order to pursue, you know, basically a clash of civilizations. And they want to blow the horn so that all Muslims around the world flock to them. There has been some flocking, but not in the millions. You're talking about in the dozens or the hundreds, you know, and at this stage, they should be treated like what they are, which is an extremely uncomfortable regional presence in a strategic part of the world, but it's also one that's becoming less and less strategic to the American government over time. Yeah. If you've noticed, we're a lot less interested in intervening in the Middle East than we have been in the last 30 or 40 years. You know, you can do a whole show on fracking and the problems with it, but one of the upsides to fracking is we care a lot less about what the Saudis think.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've already seen an ISIS veteran from France come back.
Sorry,
to
you're breaking out again.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just talking about, can you hear me? Check, check.
Yeah, I can hear you now.
I was just mentioning that there's already an ISIS veteran who's gone and done a terrorist attack in Brussels and killed, I forget if it was three or four people died in an attack on a Jewish museum. So I agree with you that they're already coming this way anyway.
It wasn't the Islamic State. That was a guy who had experience fighting what we call a lone wolf attack. And those are going to happen all over Europe, and they have been happening over Europe, you know, off and on for the last 10 years. They're just these individual psychopaths are just now doing it in the name of the Islamic State. This stuff isn't going to go away. I mean, this is a long-term chronic thing that, you know, the next generation is going to have to deal with certain forms of Islamic radicalism. There are certainly things that you can do to offset that and not make it worse, but I don't think defending Erbil was one of them. Now, sending in 150,000 American troops to fight the Islamic State, that would probably do something to polarize people. But right now, I've yet to run across even Muslims who can't stand America for the most part. You know, people who are incredibly anti-Israel. The only thing they're complaining about right now is, why didn't you do more sooner? These psychopaths are coming for us now, too. You know, I mean, these guys are really polarizing in the Muslim world. It's just they turn out to be extremely effective at combat inside failed states.
Yeah. Yeah, gee, if only Saddam with his clean-shaven chin was here, you know?
Well, you know, that's just a running joke among the press corps that covered the first invasion is, what would you give to see, you know, to hear from Saddam right now? Like, I mean, what would you give to be able to call Saddam Hussein and ask him what to do about this?
He's the guy that had the all-points bulletin out for Zarqawi.
He was a guy who understood how the levers of power in Iraq worked. I mean, he was completely evil and completely incompetent in dealing with the outside world. But in terms of his ability to understand the Iraqis, he clearly was very good at it and used extremely ruthless and brutal methods. But again, he also made sure people got paid. Maliki really didn't know how to use the carrot and the stick.
He just basically kept the carrot and beat the Sunnis with the stick until they'd had enough. And it's literally, you know, it could literally destabilize the entire region. If people are not careful, I can easily see Saudi Arabia falling. I can easily see Jordan, you know, falling into a situation in which the Israelis feel like they're forced to intervene and cause, talk about polarizing in the Muslim world at that stage.
Right.
I mean, I can't see these guys getting up through Turkey. I think that the Kurds can be bolstered and held. But it's talking about running the table on the rest of the Sunni Arab world. I don't think it's likely this year, but I can't scratch it off the chalkboard as things I'm worried about right now, because, you know, I didn't think we'd be here 6 months ago, and here we are. I'm in Erbil.
Yeah. I called it a year ago, FFF.org. thanks very much, Mitchell. I've already kept you over time. Appreciate it.
No problem. It's always a pleasure, Scott. Take it easy.
All right, y'all. That's the great Mitchell Prothero. He's reporting out of Erbil, Kurdistan, for McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. The latest is Maliki signals he'll step aside peacefully, easing tensions in Baghdad. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR silver commodity discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Stop, ceiling fan, you're making too much noise. Well, it gets hot in here, man. I'll try to turn the fan on during the break. All right, so I blew that commercial break, and then I blew the outro and whatever. But you can hear the whole show archived there at scotthorton.org/interviews soon. And, yeah, there you go. So there's Prothero on the Islamic State. Coming up here in a while, Daniel McAdams will be back on the show to talk about Iraq as well as Ukraine. I can't help but think, man, do you ever find yourself thinking that, wow, you know, maybe we're paying all this attention to what's going on in Palestine and in Iraq, and yet actually we're on the verge of a nuclear war with Russia? I mean, I don't know if that's really true, but I can't help but think that, like, hey, wait a minute, maybe I'm a little bit too distracted from what is, after all, the absolute most important thing in the world. Which is America's relationship with Russia. They got thousands, and we got thousands of H-bombs. Thousands. Okay, so there's Britain and France and Israel and Pakistan and China, India. All of their nukes combined don't equal as many as Russia has or as America has. We're holding our government, our politicians, Putin and Obama and their politicians are holding all of humanity hostage with these things. Now, maybe they could not absolutely extinct mankind, but they could destroy all of human civilization and put mankind back thousands of years or, well, I don't know, a couple of thousand anyway. When they crawl out from their bunkers, the ones who survive. So there's nothing more important in the world than having a normal, calm, warm, and peaceful relationship with Russia at virtually any cost. Not any cost, but at virtually any cost. Picking a fight with them on their own border? Using Nazi militias to overthrow their government? And then encouraging them to wage war on the people in the East who won't accept the new government, ethnically cleansing the place? There's, what, 100,000 something plus? Nearly a million, says the United Nations. Pardon me. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees fleeing into Russia? Can just imagine for 1 minute if Russia did this in Canada. Overthrew the government, used Nazi militias to seize the buildings in the capital, overran the thing, took control of the army, put the Nazi militias as the new National Guard, and started waging war against British Columbia for refusing to go along. There'd be your nuclear war right there. Even if not one shell came anywhere near the U.S. border. You can't overthrow America Junior up there. We will overthrow the Canadian government if it needs overthrowing, not you, Putin. And America would explain that by dropping hydrogen bombs on Moscow. That's true. And you know that's true. If Russia, seriously, imagine for a moment, if Russia overthrew the government of Canada and then had the new government wage war on those who refused to accept it. America would nuke Russia. We would have a nuclear war over that. That is exactly what America is doing to Russia right now. And it's true that it's more of this Obama half-assed kind of sort of, well, here's some uniforms and some MREs and, you know, some ammo for the guns you already got, or, you know, some kind of, here's some advisors. Why don't you go and get in a fight with Russia? And so the Ukrainian government is continuing to wage war in the east there. Not that they're having much success, apparently, but they're killing a lot of innocent people. And they're giving the Russians a pretext to cross the border. And now, God almighty, I, more than you even, am sick and tired of people warning that the Russians are about to cross the border. I mean, literally, I don't think a day goes by that I don't see an article or a tweet from some wannabe journalist or something somewhere saying, oh my God, the Russians are preparing to invade the East. Now, I'm not ruling that out as a possibility that they would do that. But who sits around writing a whole article about what might be about to happen in the future? They've been saying this for half a year. Since they used the Nazis to overthrow the government in Kiev back in February. And so, it's kind of a boy who cried wolf thing, but remember how that story ends. The wolf does come. And anyway, you know, here America is going to war for humanitarian, quote-unquote, reasons in Iraq. And they're warning the Russians that you better not intervene in a strictly humanitarian way. Better not do anything in Ukraine at all. The hypocrisy is glaring. And by the way, my friend Nick sent this morning the new poll that came out. Where are you at, Nick? In the news, Putin's approval rating hits all-time high, 87%. Right? Like Bush after 9/11. What? Our collective is under attack from without? All hail alpha male. That's how that works. Now, who's giving the people of Russia a reason to think that they're under assault from without and need to rally around their leader? So if Putin's such a bad guy, it's America who's made him more powerful than ever. Again, that you can't even call that blowback. That's just backdraft. That's your policy blowing up right in your face. Not, you know, a couple of years later and it was a secret policy and then the people get fooled because they don't know why the thing happened and the government and TV lies. And then at the same time, CNN poll show that trust in, Obama, this is kind of apples and oranges, but certainly Obama's approval rating is like 40-something percent, and trust in government in general is at an all-time low, Congress and the rest of them. Which is good, because, you know, the whole theory is consent of the governed, and apparently they don't have any consent. You know, except from the people who have all the power and use it shamelessly. All right, well. So here, Pentagon wants to send military trainers. This is actually from the first. It's 10 days old, 11 days old now, I'm sorry, but Pentagon said it wants to send troops to Ukraine next year as the country faces continued aggression. Aggression from pro-Russian separatists. Huh? That's how Star Wars 2 begins. I will not tolerate this aggression. of those who are attempting to declare independence and separate from their centralized rule. Yeah, that's aggression, right? Just like Cuba is a threat because it has the will to resist all this time. You get it. The Pentagon said Friday it plans to send troops to Ukraine forces, send troops to train Ukraine forces next year as the country faces continued aggression from pro-Russian separatists. According to the plan, which must be approved by Congress, yeah, right, soldiers stationed in Europe or from the California National Guard would train and equip four companies and one tactical headquarters of the Ukrainian National Guard. The effort would help build their capacity for internal defense. Internal defense. Yeah, there you go. And then, oh, someone sent me a clip this morning of a battle where it looked like the Ukrainian forces are losing bad. And then here's this Christian Science Monitor report. UN, nearly a million Ukrainians have fled fighting in the East. More on that subject with Dan McAdams coming up on the show in just a little while. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And yeah, I'm doing a little fundraiser type thing here on the show this week. Well, a little bit last week. I'm raising some funds. I've got to raise some money in order to take care of some business. And it isn't just the stupid tickets in LA, although that's the one that pisses me off the most. You got to hire a lawyer. You know, you can't even call the LA court and say, well, so what, you know, talk to, no, they don't have a phone number. There's no one to talk to. There's nothing to be done. All right. Well, yeah. So anyway, yeah, no, I need money. I need money. And I hate asking for money. This is not National Public Radio. It's supposed to be a business where I sell enough ads that I don't need to do any fundraising ever. But, well, that's just not the case. And I'm sorry, I'm bit my tongue pretty hard there. I'm sorry to come at you at the same time that it's antiwar.com fund drive right now. You ought to donate to them too. Don't give me their money. If you donate enough to them, maybe I could get my job back since I worked there full time anyway, you know, for free, basically. No hard feelings. I mean, they just don't have the money. So if you're really rich, donate to antiwar.com a lot, and also me. But you know what? The truth of the matter is, you look around, you got Doug Bandow, you got Justin Raimondo and antiwar.com. And, you know, I don't know, I'm sure Kevin Carson and all them, obviously the Future Freedom Foundation, they're going to be solid on this kind of thing. But, you know, can you count on everybody at Reason? I'm not sure. I mean, they've been good on it so far as I know, the Iraq invasion, reinvasion, I mean. Cato's been pretty good. But Reason has been just terrible. And it occurred to me, well, of course, I'm sure LouRockwell.com, yeah, they got everything anti-war going on there. The Ron Paul Institute, Dan McAdams and all them, they're all anti-war, but anyway. It's just like, you know, if the ACLU doesn't get up in the morning and sue the government all day for violating people's rights, it just doesn't get done. Well, if, you know, me and Lou and Dan McAdams and the antiwar.com crew and the few others of us in the libertarian movement who put foreign policy first and are always anti, if we don't get up in the morning and do what we do, it doesn't get done. I mean, what if libertarianism in America was left to be defined by Reason Magazine, who, you know, yeah, they might support this or that war. Lord knows their editor, Matt Welch, was sure on board, or I guess Gillespie, whichever. Welch was a horrible warmonger back in 2002 and 2003, as bad as any of them. And anyway, it's important to me that the libertarian movement has anti-war voices in it. And in fact, it's extra important to me, if it's possible, that the anti-interventionists among us, and great credit goes out to Ron Paul for helping define libertarianism in the public mind this way, that we are always anti-war. When liberals are pro-war, we're still anti. Just because they got a Democrat in the White House and they want to rally around, no, we're against it still. Oh, they call it a humanitarian mission? No, we're against it always. But if it isn't for the libertarians who take that stand, taking that stand, then it doesn't get took. Simple as that. I should say, of course, Mark and Ian at Free Talk Live and all the New Hampshire libertarians, I'm sure, are all good on intervention. That's obvious enough. But anyway, so point is, if you want this show to exist, and if you think that it matters that libertarianism is defined as an anti-interventionist thing, and you like having me as one voice that you like to point to prove it, then help support the show. Be like Tom Woods. Support the Scott Horton Show. He started donating yesterday. Anyway, I'm sorry, man. I hate talking about this stuff. What I really would rather say, in fact, I think I will for a minute, is I need advertisers, man. Advertisers. Now, I got a couple advertisers that sort of kind of went away on me. Oh, I guess one of them, two of them, I think that maybe I'll be able to get back sometime, but I don't know when. And, yeah, you know, I don't need much. If I had two or three more advertisers, I'd be, you know, running hot and doing just fine for my budget. You know, my truck is now, 19 years old, 18, 19 years old. The wife's truck is, 15 years old. We do have a house, but it's a very small, affordable one that I rent. I don't own. So I have no boat. I have no major lavish lifestyle expenses that I'm asking you to fund here. I'm just barely getting by, scrabbling in the dirt. It's like a good anti-war activist should, but need a little dirt to scrabble in, whatever that word is. Okay, so ScottHorton.org/donate. ScottHorton.org/donate. You can do monthly donations. You can do individual ones. You can donate bitcoins. There's a snail mail address there. If you'd like to send a check, I sure would appreciate that too. And thanks for your patience too and putting up with me. And thank you, extremely huge amounts of thank yous and appreciations to everyone who already has donated. And for that matter, those of you who would like to but just can't, because hey, it's the thought that counts, and I appreciate it. But yeah, I'm very grateful to the people who have taken a few bucks out to help chip in and keep the thing going. All right, good. Oh man, I'm out of time. Well, let me just say this, since I have no time before the next segment, before the next break. I was arguing with my liberal friend about gun control, and he's good on everything, except he's a liberal, so he's really bad on a lot of stuff. But so we're arguing about gun control, man. And so my thing was, but in reality, what you're talking about is gun charges, which means victimless crimes. People going to prison, man. Being separated from their families, maybe forever. Over having a gun when they're not supposed to. Over an offense against the state rather than a crime against other people. And pardon me if I think that we already have more than enough police state, and they already have more than enough laws and rules and regulations to enforce against us. And pardon me if I think that it's time to stop finding excuses to put people in prison for victimless crimes. It's crazy. There's a new one the other day. Of course, it's a poor black woman who has no political power, who has no, she's got a lawyer, but not a badass one because she can't afford it. And she's being threatened with 11 years. The prosecutor is perfectly happy to put her in prison for 11 years, even though she had her New Jersey, her Pennsylvania permit, but across the state line in New Jersey. It's just like the drug laws. It's horribly racist and prejudiced against the poor, and it's wrong. And people have the right to own guns and defend themselves. So back off, liberals. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all. Join up the chat room, man. Good times in there. ScottHorton.org/chat. ScottHorton.org/chat. Coming up, Dan McAdams, and then Will Grigg. All right, so let's talk about this new prime minister of Iraq, Haider al-Abadi. Hey, you have to admit that at least so far they're going by the constitutional process rather than scrapping it. Oh, it was United Iraqi Alliance had the whole thing in the bag all along. They wrote it, and this is still them, so... All right. Iraq's president on Monday named Haider al-Abadi as the country's new prime minister. And I'll skip the part about Maliki clinging to power because, as Mitchell Prothero was just reporting, Maliki's going to go ahead and get the hell out of the way. Someone must have made it clear to him that, you know, the CIA will kill you to death, dude. You're fired. Beat it. And he must have decided, you know what, rather than being killed, I think I'll take my money and my coke and my whores and go skiing in Switzerland. So, Maliki's gone, on his way out. But who is Abadi? Again, this is the Washington Post version. It's just all I've got so far. Okay, I'm not telling you that this is some gospel truth, but... This is what they're, a little first taste of who we're dealing with here. Who is Abadi? Born in Baghdad in 1952, Abadi was educated at the University of Baghdad and later received a doctorate from the University of Manchester in Britain. He lived in Britain for many years after his family was targeted by Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime. Trained as an electrical engineer, he entered politics after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. Now, where's the part about how he lived in England? I don't know. Anyway, I wonder how much time he spent in Iran. I also wonder whether this article is going to address that. He became Minister of Communications in the Iraqi Governing Council in September 2003, then was a key advisor to Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq's first post-invasion elected government. Just weeks ago, he was elected Deputy Speaker of the Parliament, and he has been considered a contender for Prime Minister in the last two elections. The bigger question, however, is whether Abadi will be able to overcome the challenges more successfully than Maliki. Like Maliki, he's a Shiite Muslim and is also part of Maliki's State of Law coalition. Which, boy, they're just going to paper over that he's part of the Dawah Party, which is where Maliki comes from too, which they were the Iraqi traders who lived in Iran for 30 years, most of them anyway. And so I guess you don't need to know anything about that. One of the chief criticisms of Maliki was that he entrenched Iraq's sectarian politics, filling the government with Shiite politicians and limiting Sunni and Kurdish power. Now, of course, this was American policy to back the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council. The third part of their United Iraqi Alliance coalition was Muqtada al-Sadr, but he was the one who wanted to kick the Americans and the Iranians out and be an Arab-Iraqi nationalist and make a coalition with the Sunnis. And, of course, he wanted to be in the driver's seat, but still, he was actually, you know, honestly trying to broker with them. But America made him the enemy over and over again in 2004, in 2006, and in 2007. And marginalized him in favor of the Dawah Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, who the Americans knew, favored Iran and Iran's position of splitting Iraq apart and running off with Shiistan. The American bet was that they'll want us to stay. But that didn't make any sense, because since they're the majority, and in fact, from Baghdad to Basra, all the land they're really trying to rule, they're the super-duper majority, they don't need the United States to keep them in power there. They're best friends with the Iranians next door. And so the Dawa Party, Nouri al-Maliki, who America and Iran worked together to put in power there, told the Americans to get the hell out. That's what "no, I won't sign your immunity deal" means. It means get the hell out. So they can say, oh, Maliki's too sectarian, but the answer is yes. That is why Zalmay Khalilzad and George W. Bush chose him for the job. They could have put a solderist in there, but the solderist would have told them to get lost 3 years earlier, and they had a lot more people to get killed for no reason. So, there you go. Leave it to the Washington Post to lie to you by omission like that. I mean, I know they couldn't have fit all that in there, but still a little something would have been nice. Earlier this summer, Abadi gave a striking interview with the Huffington Post's Mehdi Hassan, in which he discussed the possibility of Iranian intervention in the fight against the Islamic State, the Sunni extremist group that has taken over vast swaths of Iraq. "We are waiting for the Americans to give us support," he said in the June interview. "If U.S. airstrikes happen, we don't need Iranian airstrikes. If they don't, we may need them." Abadi has also had differences with Iraq's Kurdish community at points. Last year, he warned that a dispute over Iraqi Kurdistan's oil exports could lead to the disintegration of the country. And he was also criticized by Kurdish politicians during the negotiations over the 2013 budget. I think, as Prothero was saying, the Americans, and probably even the Kurds, would rather not have full independence as long as they still get a lot of things out of their relationship with Baghdad. But I think American pressure is a big part of that. Abadi does seem to be aware that the Iraqi government and security forces have made serious mistakes in the current conflict. He told Hassan that the Iraqi government needs to listen to the stories of the excesses of the security forces to decide how to respond. And he was clear that Iraq needed to avoid being dragged into the type of war the Islamic State clearly desires. "We've got to be careful not to become involved in a sectarian war. Shias are not against Sunnis." Yeah, right. He's from the Dawa Party, this guy. Reader Visser, an academic expert on Iraqi politics, says that while Abadi comes from the same political faction as Maliki, he enjoys much broader support, especially from Kurds and Sunni Muslim politicians, he means. Part of this is his more distinguished background. Oh yeah, that's where he gets all his street cred from, huh? He has a very prestigious family background, spent a lot of time in the UK. And yeah, oh, that counts in the Iraqi establishment, which means, yeah, what? The Supreme Islamic Council. Oh, the rich people like this guy because he's rich. Oh, okay, yeah, I could see how then he's going to really be able to get his way with the population of Iraq, which is all just like that, right? President Fouad Masoum, a Kurd, seemed confident Monday that Abadi could lead the country. "Now the Iraqi people are in your hands," he said. Oh, yeah. Well, whatever. Far too little too late. You know, if the American government had wanted to hold Iraq together as their highest priority, then they would have done everything a hell of a lot different than they did. And I don't think that the policy really was just, well, it depends on who you ask. It may have been Douglas Feith's and David Wormser's policy to just smash Iraq. But I don't even think that was Dick Cheney's policy, to just smash it into pieces. They thought it was all just going to be very easy. I mean, the idea that the population would resist and in an effective way was just the furthest thing from their minds. We'll beat the Iraqi army and then we'll have things our way, and whatever Iraqi puppets we set up after that, we'll be able to handle any problems that come up. And I don't think they really were, you know, that much worried about it. Maybe Plan C was, okay, go ahead and smash the place, but if you really look at the history of the war, it's a legacy of complete and total failure and ineptitude, and failure of not just imagination, but even understanding in the first place. You know, I remember the quote from, well, who was it? I think it was a New York Times story that had Paul Bremer say to his cute little blonde cupcake aide, who's like the daughter of some Republican donor who's a junior in college and doesn't know anything about anything at all, but who's assigned to be his right-hand deputy. He says, "Who's this Murtada al-Sadr?" And she says, "Oh, he's just this minor cleric. You don't need to worry about him." Actually, that may have been a reference to the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the highest-ranking Shiite leader in the world, now that I think about it. Huh. Anyway, back in a minute. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, man. Welcome back to the show, you guys. Coming up, Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. We'll be on to talk about Iraq and Ukraine. Ha! Obama's foreign policy criticized as the banner on CNN. But you don't even have to turn up the volume. You know what it is. He's not doing enough. Oh, he's not doing enough, say other people with power. Yeah, what do the American people say, CNN? You bastards. You disgusting, blood-soaked war criminals. Oh, yeah, over at CNN, they're so concerned about the Yazidis who they first heard of this week when the war that they championed is what's responsible for the Yazidi tragedy in the first place. Oh, look, everybody, all of a sudden there's Iraqi refugees. Sorry, we haven't told you for the last 10 years straight that America's creating millions of Iraqi refugees. Millions. At least 2.5 to 3 million who fled the country to Jordan, Syria, or wherever else the hell they could go. And another 2.5 million internally displaced in various bouts of sectarian cleansing in the American-caused and backed civil war. How much time, somebody do the media criticism research and go and show me how much CNN has ever talked about the Yazidis before, when America has been making their life miserable for at least 11 years. And that goes the same for the Assyrian and Chaldean Christians, if you can find any. They're Mesopotamian civilizations that go back 2,000 years. Yeah, they're gone. They're gone. The Druze of Iraq? There are no Druze of Iraq. Not anymore. Maybe in some camp hiding in the mountains of Kurdistan. And Jews of Iraq? Last I heard, there were 8 left in Baghdad. And that's because of America's war there. Some of those Assyrian and Chaldean, was it the Chaldeans, in not just in Syria, as we've heard about in the past year, but during the worst days of the Iraq War, I believe it was the Chaldean Christians still spoke Aramaic. They're gone. Their civilization in Iraq has been erased by America's invasion and war and occupation. Oh, now America's going to save the little Iraqis. Going to save the Iraqis? The Army and the Marine Corps fought and killed a hell of a lot of AQI guys before they were even AQI. They fought and killed Sunni insurgents from 2003 through 2010. And they didn't get rid of these guys. The Sunni tribes were able to, but not really get rid of them. Just send the message that you guys are overmatched here. Go home. That was what happened, because as soon as Obama started backing the Mujahideen in Libya and Syria, up came AQI again. Remember us? And I can show you McClatchy news stories from 2011, where it's the Obama government, when they're making excuses to the Israel lobby why they're not doing more against Assad in Syria. They say, well, look, the al-Nusra Front is basically just al-Qaeda in Iraq, man. Come back to life. They knew it all along. That's what al-Nusra is. Al-Nusra is the Syrian veterans of the war in Iraq that fought with al-Qaeda in Iraq. The Islamic State of Iraq is more bent toward the Iraqis, and then once they split off from al-Nusra, most of the rest of the foreigners went with them. The Saudis, the Libyans, and the Algerians, and Chechens, and whatever, Afghans even, went and broke off to go pal around with ISIS instead, because they had the momentum. And so Nusra is just, it's only separate from ISIS because of the personal loyalty of their leadership still to Ayman al-Zawahiri in Pakistan rather than the new guy, Baghdadi. But otherwise, they're the same guys. And the Sunni-based rebellion in Syria all along has been jihadists, veterans of the AQI. So anyway, now they're back. They were just biding their time. They weren't gone. The U.S. Army and the Marines, you know, I guess you could argue that, yes, the U.S. Army and Marine Corps with the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army, and you can tell me who's auxiliary force there. It seems to me more like the American Army and Marines were doing the bidding of the Badr Brigade and the Mahdi Army rather than the other way around, as they all worked together to cleanse Baghdad of Sunni Arabs, especially in 2007. So I guess you could concede that, yes, the Army and the Marine Corps were powerful enough to put enough firepower on these people to force them into a position where they had too many enemies. They had ISIS guy or AQI guys who were out of control, and they had the Shiite militias and the U.S. Army. And so they called time out, basically. And yet, really, I remember going back, and I'm sorry, I should have wrote all this down and saved the page, stuck it on my wall or something where I wouldn't forget, because I actually had it all together in a row where I had, off the top of my head, at the end of 2008 would have been the time frame for this, if you want to go back and find it in the archives for me. At the end of 2008, I had it by rote, all of the different footnotes that I needed to prove that the Sunnis, the Sunni insurgency leaders, the Ba'athists and the Sunni imams and tribal leaders, they had offered in 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, please just let us patrol our own neighborhoods, give us some guns, give us some money, and we'll stop fighting you and call off the Shiite militias, please. And the Americans told them, no, 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 yes. Finally, at the beginning of 2007, after they'd already been fighting, turning on al-Qaeda and fighting them, for a year throughout 2006, especially the later part of 2006, Petraeus came and said, okay, fine, I'll accept your offer. Here's some money, here's some guns, stop shooting our guys. But he waited until he got the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad accomplished first. And all I was trying to say was, that's the proof that the Army and the Marine Corps, for all their fighting in Mosul and in Ramadi and in Fallujah, they were never able to get rid of al-Qaeda in Iraq from the Sunni parts of the country. They were able to make Baghdad no longer a Sunni part of the country. If you want to give them credit, yeah, a million people died in their horrible sectarian civil war that they fought on behalf of Abdulaziz al-Hakim and Muqtada al-Sadr and their bloody torture militias. Remember, they would kill people by drilling with power drills through their eyeball into their brain to death. That's a nice way to die, at the hands of American-backed militias. 3,000 people a month dying, their bodies stacked up in the morning on the side of the road like cordwood. They never were able to conquer Fallujah. Victory! We're going to kick ass, Bush said in his cheerleading little speech to the generals, according to General Sanchez. Come on, kick ass! They can't stand up! We're marching to democracy! This is my favorite George W. Bush quote ever. Are you ready? There are a series of moments, and this is one of them. Yeah. Boy, I love it when you get all existential and stuff, man. That's just great. So they attack Fallujah, accomplish nothing other than creating a sectarian bloodbath there and getting all the Shiites kicked out of there. And in fact, making Zarqawi a hero of the Sunni insurgency there. He declared his loyalty to bin Laden and rose to prominence and fought for 2 years and killed at least tens of thousands of people with his suicide attackers over the next couple of years after that. That's all they accomplished with attacking Fallujah. Petraeus did a mini surge and bribery scheme in Mosul in 2004. All he ended up doing was handing nobody knows how many hundreds of thousands of AK-47s and millions of dollars to the Sunni insurgents who later used them on American forces. Boy, he never gets in trouble for that one. He was just ahead of his time, man, that's all. But anyway, so all America's best forces can do is make more of these guys. I mean, they killed tens of thousands of, well, at least thousands of Zarqawi followers back then in the heyday of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and all they ever did was make more of them. So how they're supposed to do a damn thing about what's going on now? I mean, they could invade and turn back into insurgents, but still not accomplish anything, really. Stay forever. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And again, sorry to trouble you, but it is fundraising week here at the show. I don't know why I should be ashamed. Antiwar.com does their fund drive. KPFK does their fund drive. I'm doing my fund drive. ScottHorton.org/donate. So, that's all I got to say about that. All right. Next up on the show is our friend Dan McAdams from the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Welcome back. How are you doing?
Hi, Scott. Great to be back with you.
Very good to have you here. And so, first of all, let's talk about Iraq here a little bit, Dan. So, man, all over the place, it seems like, not just Reason Magazine, but all over the place, people who, not necessarily just libertarians, I haven't been taking the temperature of the whole damn libertarian movement or anything, but I have seen all over the place, at least liberals who certainly ought to know better, saying, well, geez, you know, got to go save the Yazidis. And everybody seems agreed that this Iraq War III is just a humanitarian mission, Dan. And so I wonder, what's your problem?
Yeah, exactly. It is amazing. The same people who were burned in 2002, who, you know, some of them did a mea culpa, but a lot of them didn't. But here they are back again for more punishment, you know. And we actually just put up a good article by Pepe Escobar, who's always entertaining, but also very insightful. And he makes the point that this whole idea about it being a humanitarian gesture was basically an afterthought that the Obama administration tagged on because he knew that he would get a lot of people on board. But what Pepe points out, and I think it's a pretty good point, is that a lot of this has to do with avoiding another Benghazi because, you know, in Kurdistan there is a U.S. consulate, quote-unquote, that's home to thousands of CIA agents who are running around doing all sorts of things. And there was a real danger that this place would be overrun. And he points out that that has a lot to do with it, as also the idea of a regime change in Baghdad, which we're seeing sort of a slow-motion regime change over the past couple of days, where the U.S. once again gets tired of its puppet and wants to put a new one in power. Mm-hmm. So, unfortunately, people are very gullible, and you wrap it in a humanitarian angle. And nobody stops to think, well, hold on, if bombs created this mess in the first place, how can more bombs solve the mess, you know, afterward? So it is a very unpleasant situation to watch so many people falling behind yet more war propaganda.
Yep. All right. Now, so here's the thing about the Islamic State, though, is that when Patrick Coburn compares them to Nazis, their fanaticism to the Nazis, their chauvinism, when he compares their mentality to the Khmer Rouge, that they're, you know, basically just nihilistic butchers, perfectly happy to kill women and children without the slightest thought, just as much as a fighter, and hell-bent on, you know, one way or another, a final solution of the Shiite problem and whatever other problems that they bring on for themselves. And so what about that? What about the fact that, you know what, when they called Noriega Hitler, it was a stupid joke. It was ridiculous. But if you call this guy Baghdadi Hitler and the people around him a bunch of, you know, fanatics as bad as Nazis, man, you might have a point there. So isn't the lesson of World War II? We got to start these wars earlier to prevent the rise of people who are really this bad from coming into power, Dan.
Now, there may be something to that, but you know when the time to stop this war was? It was to stop it back in the mid-2000s when the U.S. put forth the surge, the Sunni awakening, the Arab awakening, that is what created this group in the first place. Yes, starting it earlier, which is to have said years ago to Saudi Arabia, stop supporting these lunatics. You provided them training, you've supplied them weapons for years because your pet project, getting rid of Assad. And now you've created, as Coburn himself says, a Frankenstein monster. Stopping it early would have been for the U.S. to tell Turkey, stop leaving your border open for the transshipment of weapons to these lunatics who now make up more than 80% of the resistance against Assad in Syria. Stopping it earlier would have meant telling the CIA, stop training these people in secret bases in Jordan and Turkey. The vetting process, as we all know, it's been well reported, was haphazard at best. So, and actually, David Stockman has a new article out that's very good. He says, how is it that these guys became so adept at using very high-tech precision weaponry in very short order? You know, dot, dot, dot. The answer is they've been trained by the CIA for years. So I would agree with people who say that. Stop it before it starts. Unfortunately, the horses are already out of the barn. It's already started. And nobody's looking at the people who caused the problem in the first place and who continue to exacerbate the problem.
Yeah. Or worse, they say, this is America's responsibility, you know. We're the ones who put these poor people in this position. And so now we've got to help them even more than if we were just some other third bystander country here.
And even if you accept that argument, which I don't accept it for certain reasons, even if you accept that argument, the question is the approach that the U.S. is taking, will that be effective in solving the problem? Or does the U.S. even give 2 cents, I was going to say something stronger, about these people? You know, 500,000 Christians disappeared from Iraq under U.S. occupation. Nobody said a word. Christianity has been decimated in Syria, but because they were seen to be allied with Assad, who protected them, the U.S. didn't say a word. So the U.S. has lied about its concern for ethnic and religious minorities in the region when convenient. So why should we believe them now that they even care about these people? But supposing they did, how do we know that this approach is the right approach? It's not been successful in the past.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying, too. I guess, and the good news is that Western Iraq is not necessarily, you know, paradise. I mean, there are a couple of rivers run through it and all that, but whatever oil resources are there are not that much. And so these guys might be, and I'm sorry, audience, I repeat myself a bit sometimes when I'm really, really right about something. These guys might be as fanatical as a bunch of Nazis, but they don't have a Germany to rule here. They've got a, you know, piece of crap desert to rule, and they're hemmed in by enemies on all sides. I don't know, man. Dan, seriously, real world stuff. Never mind, you know, ideology, because you and I could beat the hell out of everybody on ideology. But real life, if Ron Paul was the president and you were his national security advisor and Iraq was, this was the final falling apart of the Iraqi state and war and men, women and children being killed and all of this madness. Seriously, what would you tell him to do?
Well, to accept the fact that Iraq is an artificial nation, probably, to accept the fact that it probably will break up no matter what you do. The only thing you can do with military force is exacerbate the problem. You could use leverage, of course. You could tell Saudi Arabia to knock it off. You could tell Turkey to knock it off. You could tell the CIA to knock it off, although you might get JFK'd if you do that. But, you know, you can do, there are things that can be done.
Like Ron Paul, we said, well, you know, I'm going to bring my own security to the White House. I don't really trust their Secret Service.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There are things that can be done. But, you know, this is how propaganda works. You know, it's, as we talked about last time I was on your show, it's not enough to oppose war. You have to oppose war propaganda. Mm-hmm. And the propaganda works by tugging at the heartstrings of people and saying, we've got to do something about these people. Okay, we all agree on that. Will this help? Probably not. It hasn't in the past.
Yep.
And, you know, what's interesting, you talk about it's just a piece of junk in the desert. But interesting that Kurdistan has now captured the oil fields in Kirkuk, which they've been salivating over for years. And you can bet your bottom dollar there are a lot of the equivalents of Joe Biden's son who over there profiteering on this as well.
Yeah, they're, including on CNN. I mean, Peter Galbraith, who worked for George Bush over there, you know, there's an article at Forbes, the $100 million oil patch, all about Peter Galbraith, and he's on CNN today saying, we got to fight for the Kurds. Oh, really?
Yeah, yes, exactly. You saw the same thing, as you remember well, in Kosovo, where Madeleine Albright and Wesley Clark and others all of a sudden became huge industrial tycoons down there after they liberated Kosovo. The same thing is happening in Ukraine with Biden's son and others, and in the oil fields of Kurdistan now Kurdistan.
It's amazing. You know, it goes to show how far a lack of shame can get you. You know, you can do real well in American politics as long as you don't care if everybody knows just what a crooked, corrupt, lying, murdering thief you are. All right, well, hang on a minute. We'll be right back with Dan McAdams, formerly worked on Capitol Hill. Couldn't keep it, though. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Hey, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Dan McAdams. He's at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. We're talking about the nightmare of Iraq War III going on there in the Islamic State. But now to World War III, maybe. Let's get an update on what's going on lately in Ukraine. Dan, first of all, I'd like to ask you, I guess, about the state of the fighting and how much progress the Ukrainian military is making against the separatists in the east.
Well, it looks like, you know, the Donetsk region is somewhat encircled by the Ukrainian forces, and Luhansk is a little bit. It has a border with Russia still. So, you know, things don't look that great for the rebels in the east, but aside from that, things look much worse for the civilians on the ground who have not been part of the fighting, but who've taken the brunt of the fighting. Obviously, from both sides, it's been disruptive, but, you know, there's plenty of evidence that the Kiev forces are simply wantonly shelling apartment buildings and blowing people up as they walk down the streets. So it's a humanitarian disaster that is, you know, up there with Gaza, really, but nobody wants to talk about it because these aren't the right kinds of people to be helped. And that's why you don't see the U.S. media worried about it or the U.S. government. You know, when they do say something, they say that, well, they're bombing themselves. You know, this is they did say it about Gaza as well. So they're not favored, and they're in a terrible situation. They've not had electricity or water in weeks. And, you know, they're trying to stream across the border to Russia or anywhere to survive, and it's a terrible tragedy.
All right, now, so the United Nations is saying, and you know, even I was surprised by this, and we've been talking about this, you and me and others on this show have been talking about this for months now, about the you know, ethnic Russians in the east, the civilians fleeing to Russia. And I guess just because of the dearth of reporting, or maybe I just haven't been looking closely enough, I was surprised to find out, Dan, here in the Christian Science Monitor, that the UN is saying that almost 1 million people have fled eastern Ukraine for Russia. So I guess, you know, they don't have to win a bunch of military victories if they can just scare all the population away.
It's a way of, I mean, I wrote about it a few weeks ago. It's a way of ethnic cleansing the whole area and opening up to what have you, opening up to fracking so that Biden's son can make a fortune. Who knows? But it is an absolute disaster. No one's talking about it. As a matter of fact, I forget, it was a few weeks ago that one of the State Department spokespersons, I don't remember if it's Psaki or the other one, when asked about it, implied that these were just people going to visit their grandmothers in Russia, you know, which is so callous and disgusting, but so typical of how these people are framing this issue.
Yeah, that's crazy. And now, as far as American intervention, can you tell us about the extent of actual, you know, as far as you know, of, you know, intelligence and or special forces type activity there by the United States or our allies in helping the Ukrainian military?
Well, we know because they've announced it, that they've sent in a number of advisors, including people from special forces, as is always the case with advisors, to help them figure out how to win in eastern Ukraine. You know, this is the escalation on the part of the West, all the same time it yells at Russia not to escalate when we don't even see any evidence of Russia escalating. You know, the irony of the past week is, as the U.S. was bombing Iraq for humanitarian reasons, it told Russia not to send in any medicine or food because the humanitarian needs should not be addressed by those who caused the problem in the first place.
Yeah.
So the irony there is awfully thick. But the latest thing really is this 287 trucks from Russia with aid, with food and medicine and things to support the civilian population in eastern Ukraine under the auspices of the Red Cross and with the agreement of the initial agreement of the Ukrainian government. When I went to bed last night, they were leaving Moscow and everything seemed to be fine. I woke up this morning and Ukraine said, no, they can't come in. They're transporting S-300 rockets, into Ukraine, which, of course, we would know if that were the case. And then the latest we've seen is that apparently they will let them in, but who knows what kinds of hoops they'll be forced to jump through. You know, but there's this 200 and some white trucks that are full of humanitarian supplies. And, you know, if they are weapons, it would be probably the stupidest thing the Russians ever did. Because if they wanted to sneak them over, there certainly are better ways than putting them in these big white trucks.
Right. But so the Americans are publicly warning the Russians, you better not intervene like this. And then so the Red Cross intervenes and brokers the deal.
Yeah, it says, no, don't. Even if you deliver food, we're going to consider it an invasion, is what the U.S. said.
Yeah.
Which is pretty bad. You know?
Well, and of course, when they run out of talking points to say for a little while, they just go right back to, oh, the Russians are about to invade. They're about to invade, which they've been saying for 6 months straight.
Yeah, amassing troops on the border. And, you know, the Western press are stenographers, not only for Washington, but Kiev as well. So every crazy thing that comes out of the mouth of these leaders who went from the streets of Maidan into parliament, where they're still fighting each other, you know, if you've looked at any video from the Ukrainian parliament, you see endless fights going on in parliament. But they have the same street fighting mentality. They're saying the same crazy things. But the U.S. media, with very few exceptions, repeats it word for word.
Yeah. Seems like they'd push back a little bit after 6 months of this, about to intervene. Do you have a Facebook post to show me or anything up there? You know, come on.
That's this great AP reporter, Matt Lee, who keeps antagonizing these young State Department gals. You know, do you at least have some social media you can show us as proof?
Yeah, something. well.
And what they don't say is that this is their own soil. And can you imagine if there was this kind of thing happening on the Mexican border with the threat of spilling over into the U.S.? You're telling me that we wouldn't have any military? Right. Look at this town. This town in, what is it, Missouri, last night, where there was a little bit of rioting over an African-American kid being killed by the cops. It looks like it's been invaded by the U.S. military.
Yeah. Well, that's our next interview with Will Gregg coming up in just a second.
Oh, perfect. Exactly. That's exactly it. So you're telling me if this were happening on the border with Mexico, the U.S. wouldn't move some troops down there?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, and you know, and I'm sorry because we're just about out of time here, Dan, but I wanted to point out here this piece in The Hill about from the 1st of August about sending in more trainers and contractors and all that, and just the way they frame it, speaking of stenography, that and it's just such doublethink, right, in the first sense. The Pentagon said it plans to send troops to train Ukrainian forces next year as the country faces continued aggression from pro-Russian separatists. So they're not even claiming that, yeah, they're trying to invade and conquer Kiev here or anything. They're separatists, and attacking them is defense from their aggression, all in one sentence.
Yeah.
There you go. And there's the damn music. I wasted the end of your interview there. Sorry, Dan. Soon, we will do this again. Thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's Dan McAdams. He's at the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. It's ronpaulinstitute.org. And we'll be right back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Wrapping up now with our friend Will Grigg. Great chronicler of American, mostly local, police abuse. And his website is Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And his book is Liberty in Eclipse. And he's got a radio show off and on. I can never memorize what time it does come on, but you can find the archives there if you just look for the links there at Pro Libertate. Welcome back to the show, Will. How are you doing?
Scott, it's always good to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Good, good. Very happy to have you on the show here. So, well, I guess I just got one question for you. Who's Mike Brown?
Mike Brown is now deceased. He was an 18-year-old man from a little town in Missouri called Ferguson. And he was shot fatally by a police officer a few days ago as the result of what is being described by Chief John Belmar of the Ferguson Police Department as an encounter in the street. And it is pretty clear on the basis of what is known from eyewitness accounts that Mr. Brown was unarmed at the time, that he had been fleeing from a police officer while unarmed, and that he had been shot, grazed probably once and then shot a second time before he fell to the ground, raising his hands, pleading not to be shot anymore because he didn't have a gun. He was killed by a shot that was fired from a distance of about 35 feet from the patrol vehicle. And according to an eyewitness on the scene, one of his friends, a man by the name of Dorian Johnson, at no time did Mr. Brown pose a threat to anybody, including the police officer, who simply rolled up on them and then barking at them, demand that they get on the sidewalk, took offense over the fact that Mr. Johnson explained that they were almost at their destination. This didn't happen in the early morning hours or late at night. This happened, as I understand it, in the afternoon on Saturday. So in plain daylight, you have a couple of young men who are doing nothing to attract the suspicion of any reasonable person, who are accosted by a police officer, who flings in their face a vulgar expression, a gerund form, if you will, of the familiar Anglo-Saxon term for sexual congress, and tells them to get on the sidewalk. Out of nowhere, apparently, came this instruction. These are adults or near adults. In any case, if they're walking in the street, not causing harm to anybody, perhaps you could suggest that in the interest of their own safety, they might want to move.
Well, and this is no major thoroughfare with a double yellow line or anything.
Exactly. This is a placid neighborhood. It's not as if they were in any way impeding traffic or posing a risk to themselves. This is an instance of a uniformed bully trying to provoke something with a couple of people who seem to be an easy target. Now, according to Mr. Johnson, what happened is that after he very politely told the police officer that they were almost at his home, which is where they were going, and of course he didn't have to tell the police officer anything, the officer slammed on his brakes, threw the car into the reverse, actually he described it as a truck, and nearly hit them, and then tried to come boiling out of the car at them, out of the vehicle at them. And as he opened the door, the car door slammed into Mr. Brown, who's a very large young man, recent high school graduate, once again 18 years old, about to go to trade school. And the door careened off of Mr. Brown and then shut, slammed shut on the police officer. And at that point, according to Dorian Johnson's account, the police officer reached to the window and grabbed Brown by the neck and started to choke him while saying that he was going to shoot him. And Brown disentangled himself and fled, and as this happened, one gunshot was fired, and the two of them, of course, gave flight. And at some point, Brown was hit a second time, fell to the ground, and then was shot from, once again, a distance of about 35 feet. And the way that the police chief is describing this is quite interesting. This is Chief Belmar's description. Yesterday, about noon, he gave this account on Sunday. Yesterday, about noon, in the 2900 block of Canfield, a Ferguson police officer had an encounter with two individuals on the street. In fact, one of those individuals, and there is an ellipsis here, one of those individuals allegedly pushed the police officer back into the car where he physically assaulted the police officer. It is our understanding at this point in the investigation that within the police car there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car. After that, the officer went back, came back out of the car, he exited his vehicle, and there was a shooting that occurred where the officer, in fact, shot the subject, and there were fatal injuries. Note the impersonal construction of language here. He didn't say that the police officer shot and killed this man. He said there were shots that were fired and fatal injuries that were inflicted by some impersonal force other than the police officer in question. That's very standard self-exculpating diction from a police official.
Well, you know, it just completely changed my mind and erased everything that you just told me, and now I see it the cop's way because he is so sophisticated with his propaganda there, Will.
Well, that's one of the purposes of teaching them to spew that type of verbiage. But one thing that I want to point out is that taken on a factual level, this account, apart from significant omissions, is not significantly different materially from what Dorian Johnson said. The biggest question is, was the contact with the police officer as a result of the door slamming against the police officer after it had battered Mr. Brown, which is what Dorian Johnson, the only witness on the scene who didn't have an interest in defending the police officer, said. The police officer actually precipitated this by thrusting open his door, and then after the door ricocheted off of Brown, he was hit by the door and then reached through the door to grab the guy. Thing is, the claim that there was a struggle for the weapon is very key to what the police are going to do now in terms of trying to create a narrative, because the justification for this shot has to reside in the police officer's claim that he was in reasonable fear for his life or for the life of other people because this individual has supposedly tried to take the gun from him. And the account given by the police chief doesn't explain in any way why the contact took place, why it was seen as necessary by the police officer to have an encounter with these two people, or why there was a so-called struggle. Now, the struggle described by Johnson makes perfect sense. If somebody grabs you by the throat and threatens to kill you, you're going to try to extricate yourself from the grasp of that assailant and protect yourself. Mm-hmm. That makes sense on its face. Now, the police officer's view of things makes sense if you've been fitted with the proper ideological lenses. That is to say, if you're a police officer or somebody who's a fellow traveler with the police, or if you're somebody who has digested the standard narrative here that young black men are dangerous by virtue of who they are rather than anything they do or what they appear to be doing.
Yeah, well, it sure is true that you can see from out of the cop's point of view that, well, he said a thing, and then rather than immediately complying, they said a thing back. Well, that means, blam, escalation there. And so your throat is fair game. From the point of view of a cop, no problem there. And, of course, the door thing, obviously, like you're saying, that even the cop's version makes the other witness's story sound more correct, that the door just bounced off the kid because the cop was so clumsy in attempting to attack him in the first place. But from the cop's point of view, all this escalation is completely legitimate the whole time. But then, is it, I don't know, what is the law on stop or I'll shoot from a cop? Does it matter if it has to be, you know, a felony in progress or anything like that? Or are they banned from doing that? Is it a state-by-state issue? And I'm not talking about morality, just legality here, Will.
You're talking from a positivist perspective here. What they're going to do right now, the police officer in question, his name is being withheld from the public. He's benefiting from the so-called Garrity principle under Garrity versus New Jersey. That's about a 45-year-old decision, which says that during an investigation of suspected police misconduct, If you, in the course of being interviewed by your superiors, talk about what happens, everything you disclose cannot be used for the purpose of criminal or civil prosecution. It can only be used for the purpose of administrative rulings and perhaps interagency discipline. So the first thing this cop did was he invoked his Garrity rights. He got with his union rep and probably with an attorney. And for the last couple of days, they've been trying to craft a narrative that would be compatible with the 1985 Supreme Court ruling Tennessee versus Garner, which involved a set of facts which are not that dissimilar. You had an 18-year-old man of slight build who was unarmed, who was suspected of a burglary, who was shot in the back by a Tennessee police officer. And in that case, the Supreme Court said there are limits to the force that can be used if you're dealing with a fleeing suspect who's unarmed. So they're trying to make this set of facts, as they would present them, comport with the Tennessee versus Garner decision.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, you guys, welcome back. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. It's fundraising week at scotthorton.org/donate. Sorry, I'm not going to try to beat you over the head, but I will try to direct you over there. scotthorton.org/donate. Got some fractions of some bitcoins today. All right, thank you very much, guys. All right, Will Grigg, we're talking about the killing by the police in Ferguson, Missouri, on the outskirts of St. Louis, of a guy named Mike Brown at the hands of the local police there, and how this cop just started a fight for no reason, escalated it to the point where he ended up murdering this kid. And now there's so much more to talk about. If there's any points of fact about the actual confrontation there that you feel are necessary to go back over, Will, I'd like to give you a moment to. Otherwise, I'd like to move on to what you have to say about the reaction of the people of Ferguson and the reaction to the reaction by the police and on down that trail, too.
On the subject of facts, of course, we know what the primary eyewitnesses said. We know what we've gotten secondhand from Police Chief John Belmar. And in the latter case, you have a narrative which is massaged for the purpose of making the officer look reasonable, and that's the standard that they're trying to meet, is the so-called reasonable officer standard for the 1985 Tennessee versus Garner ruling. The Garner in that case was not Eric Garner, who was recently killed on the streets of New York by the NYPD. It was a young man by the name of Edward Garner back in 1974. He was suspected of burglarizing a home. It was late at night. He was 17 or 18 years old, about 5'7", of slight build. And the police officer who shot him, a man by the name of Hyman, says that he was convinced that the suspect was unarmed, but he was trying to scale a fence to escape. The officer shouted, "Stop or I'll shoot." The suspect fled. The officer fired several rounds, one of which hit Mr. Garner in the back of the head and killed him. And under Tennessee law at the time, and under the standards and practices of the police department employing the police officer, this was considered appropriate, because if a suspect tried to flee or resist arrest, the Tennessee state law said that you could use all necessary force in order to prevent this. This took about 11 years to get to the Supreme Court. When the court ruled on it, what they said was that force may not be used, meaning lethal force, against a fleeing suspect unless necessary to prevent the escape and the officer has probable cause to believe that the suspect poses a significant threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or others. That's one of the reasons why police in Ferguson are placing such stock on the claim that there was a struggle for the officer's gun, which is something no other eyewitness to the event testifies to seeing, including, of course, Mr. Johnson, who was right next to Brown when this took place. If Johnson was in possession of the gun, forgive me, if Brown was in possession of the gun for so much as a picosecond, the police are trying to say is that he was not an unarmed suspect, and supposedly, I guess, that status had branded him for the rest of the encounter. Or they could say that by trying to reach for the officer's gun, he was evincing the type of danger that a reasonable officer would take into account, and given his violent tendencies, he cannot be allowed to escape. Thus, this would supposedly justify the use of lethal force. There's a possibility here that after being threatened by the officer for no reason, that Brown took preemptive action to try to prevent the officer from shooting him, because according to Johnson, the gun was already out by the time that Brown was fleeing. And if the officer is saying, I'm going to shoot you, and he reaches for his gun, it's an entirely reasonable thing to surmise that what Brown was doing was he was trying to redirect the officer's gun hand away from him so he wouldn't be killed. So what's going to happen is that the police are going to investigate this. They're going to exonerate the officer. We can, I think, lay odds on that, that the officer is going to be exonerated under practices and principles and standard procedure for Ferguson, and they're going to invoke the Garner reasonable officer standard. And then after doing so, qualified immunity will attach, and the only way that the police are going to be, well, not the police aren't going to be held accountable, the only way that the city of Ferguson is going to be held accountable is through a civil action that will be filed by the victim's family that will result in a settlement that will be paid by the insurance carrier and indemnified to some measure by the tax victims within Ferguson's jurisdiction. And I suspect that's how we're going to see things play out over the next several years. Now, that assumes that things remain relatively stable in Ferguson. On the evidence of what happened over the last weekend or so, it appears, first of all, that the residents of this town, I think two-thirds of them are black, have had a surfeit of being treated like serfs, subject to an army of occupation, and secondly, that the police are doing whatever they can in order to exacerbate that attitude on the part of and that conflict with the residents of Ferguson. Because, as I point out in the piece I just published this morning on Lou Rockwell's blog, there's a video clip of your standard issue skinhead armored cretin working for one of the police agencies there who's hurling invective at the protesters, referring to them as blanking animals and telling them to bring it on.
Wait. You said that too fast. Calling them, never even mind the blanking part, calling them animals. Then, I'm sorry, you were saying?
And telling them to bring it on. You know, come at me, bro, to use the standard vernacular. And so what you're dealing with here is a group of people. In terms of the described behavior of the officer that initiated this encounter and that shot Brown, and the documented behavior of this officer in this film clip, they're seeking to provoke and suppress rather than to protect and serve. And I suspect that many of the people who arrived after the demonstration gathered steam on Saturday and then evolved to a march on Sunday were the type of people who were attracted by the prospect of tumult and violence, because they went and looted some of the stores as a way of supposedly expressing their outrage over what the state had been doing. They attacked the local business owners. And naturally, the police did nothing to protect property. They wanted to restore order. They wanted to force these people to submit. That didn't involve protecting the proprietors of the Quick Trip or some of the other businesses that were nearby. Right. To the extent that property was protected, as this protest, this peaceful protest, unfortunately calved off a violent uprising against property. To the extent the property was protected, it was protected by armed property owners. They showed up with their guns and they protected their property the way that the Korean merchants did during the so-called Rodney King riot.
Yeah. And of course, like you're saying, the whole thing was provoked by the cops' response. That, oh, you guys are mad at us? Instead of saying, now, listen, we're real sorry, but we're going to have a real investigation here, and everybody please go home, or even trying to be reasonable whatsoever. They call out full military squad, the MRAP, the camouflage, the machine guns, and march down the street and provoke, you know, you want a war, we'll give you a war kind of attitude to everybody. And then the riot breaks out and the Quickie Mart, you know, burns down. But it was the cops who caused the riot. And not just with killing the innocent guy, but then all their provocations after that. And then they leave the store owners to their own devices to defend themselves from
an angry mob. They find the smoldering embers of resentment. They pour accelerant on them. You've got the so-called firemen acting as giddy arsonists. And the other thing that I think is interesting is that several accounts, contemporaneous accounts, and this is one of the wonderful things about Twitter, from reporters and civic officials on the scene, described how police officers would refer to this as a war zone, and they literally clamped down a cordon sanitaire around that neighborhood and didn't let anybody in or out after they'd brought in the paramilitary force. And you see these pictures of these people clad in full military regalia, wearing gas masks, and wreathed in a haze of tear gas. And this, of course, is, I suppose, what law and order looks like, particularly in places like Ferguson, Missouri. The other thing I thought was interesting is that there was an alderman on the scene who was part of the peaceful demonstration who was accosted by several of these people wearing gas masks and riot gear, and at least two of them pointed their weapons at him. And he's a member of the local elected government, the civic government of Ferguson. And when I saw that picture, it reminded me of my own experience in 1983 in Guatemala after the military coup that uprooted Efrain Rios Montt, who himself had achieved the presidency through a coup. Now, I was in a little town in Guatemala confronting people that dressed exactly the same way, and I had the same kind of weapons pointed at me because I mouthed off to one of them. Their excuse was that they were a third-world banana republic that was having a military coup. This is middle America in 2014.
Right. You know what? Let me ask you this, and talk about it real fast because we're almost out of time, but I know that you wrote about this recently, about the town in Michigan where they're saying, no, enough of that, and we're using our democracy to fire this police chief and hire a new one. How's that working out, and does it, more important question in the limited time, does that augur a real change in American society that finally the regular folk are getting fed up with this? We're all black people now, and we don't want to be treated this way.
Yeah, you're talking about Victor Pierce, who said that the Lord had a plan for him and deposited him in this little town called, if I remember correctly, for heaven's sake.
I forget, too. It's some township, something.
Yeah, I think Berry Township. Berry Township in Michigan. Basically a fly speck on the map. They have one police officer most of the time. They had four when he was made police chief. They don't need a police department. He created a reserve force of nearly 40 people and let them loose on the local population to plunder and harass them. And he got four armored vehicles through the 1033 program in the Pentagon. Finally, after his goons beat up a businessman back in May, people organized an effort to get rid of him, and he was not inclined to go until it became a matter of media scandal. And last week, he was forced to resign. And so
did succeed in get rid of him, huh?
Yeah, they forced him to resign out of shame and out of media exposure. And besides that, he's already drawing a pension from his 30-year career with the police force in nearby Battle Creek. So, you know, some places I think people have reached peak jackboot. I don't know whether that's going to be national, but we're seeing little pockets of resistance arise. And, you know, may God prosper them and propagate this. I hope this becomes a contagion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, the quotes in the article that I read at the Detroit Free Press was they had a lady in her 70s saying, well, those people, they know what the law is, and whatever, but she doesn't know what the law is. Not anymore. She's pretending, and her mind is stuck back in 1960-something when at least the average white person could go about their day without being harassed all day, but she doesn't know what's really going on out there. And the only other quote they could find of somebody defending it was a government employee, so their opinion clearly doesn't count.
One of the residents I spoke with said that Victor Pierce had found his constituency. He was basically, I'm guessing, finding the Fox News constituency and filling their minds with nonsense about how this little township was, I guess, the strategic linchpin of the United States and was going to be beset upon by jihadists and school shooters and drug lords and all this stuff. They have no measurable crime right there. And so he managed to find the right constituency going from church to church and propagating the idea that unless they allowed him to create a garrison state in that little township, that the terrorist would win. And apparently there's a larger number of rational people in that little township than there were people who know only what Bill O'Reilly tells them.
Right. Well, and again, like you're saying, it was one of those where they got somebody who was prominent in, you know, it looked like a bad situation, but they pushed it so far that the town rallied around him instead of around them, and maybe that's a really unique circumstance, but I hope it helps drive the message home that, you know, it's supposed to be, and of course we always knew that this is always a lie anyway, but it'd be nice if they could at least leave it plausible for a little while longer, try to make it a little bit plausible that we come first and we're born free and we hired them to be our security force to protect us from, you know, real criminals who would violate our rights, that kind of thing. That's the PR. And they're so far away from that kind of frame of reality that they're jeopardizing their entire state legitimacy in the minds of more and more people all the time. So for their own self-preservation, I think they really need to dial this back. I was even thinking maybe I could write a letter to John Walsh, the most cop-worshipping guy on all of TV, and say, hey, listen, man, if you really want to protect these guys, you need to tell them to tone it down a little bit, dude, because people are starting to hate their guts like Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I don't know. Anyway, we're over time. I already wasted a bunch of your interview. But, Will, thank you so much for coming back on the show and paying such close attention to these issues for us, and we'll do this again soon.
All right, you take care, Scott.
Appreciate it. That's the great Will Grigg, everybody. And yeah, I blew it on that outro. I gave him a great outro on that first break, but my mic was off. These things happen. Whatever, I don't care. Thanks, everybody, for listening. See you tomorrow. Oh, yeah, freedominourtime.blogspot.com.